most of the new pieces used to be one dance tune after another, or for the morning next, a similar enchainment of hymns. No connection. Jig, Sarabande, Bourré, La La La, well, a trip through the zinnias of life, and How Merry, of course. But my stuff, Thelmer, waving a sheaf of music sheets, all has become departure and sentimental crisis, the sandwich filling, it seems. And at last, return to the tonic, safe at home. No need even to play loud at the end. Mason and Dixon's West Line. Aunt Euphrenia, setting her oboe carefully upon the arm of her chair, in fact shares this modern quality of departure and return, wherein, year upon year, the ritornelli are not merely the same notes again and again, but variant each time. As clocks have ticked onward, chance has dealt fair and foul, life, willy-nilly, has been lived through. As to journey west, adds the Reverend helpfully, in the same sense as the sun is to live, raise children, grow older, and die, carried along by the stream of the day. Whilst to turn eastward is somehow to resist time and age, to work against the wind, seek ever the dawn, even, as who can say, defy death. A drama guaranteed every time a reed woman picks up her instrument, wick-wax, a novel in music, whose hero, instead of proceeding down the road, having one adventure after another, with no end in view, comes rather through some catastrophe and back to where she set out from. No place like home, eh? Guffaws Lomaxley Spark. Doesn't sound too revolutionary to me, declares Uncle Ives. Sounds like a good sermon aimed at keeping the country people in their place. That's because you ain't hearing it aright, Nunk. 'Tis the elder world turned upside down. Ethelmer banging out a fragment of the tune of that title, played at the surrender of Cornwallis. 'Tis a lengthy step in human wisdom, sir. Oh dear, beware then, the Reverend groans in a manner he has learned, if challenged, to pass off as stomach distress. Ethelmer seems dangerous to him somehow, and not only because of Tenebrae, toward whom these days he is undergoing deep avuncularity with its own jangle of sentiments pure and impure. Yet, leaving all that out, there remains to the boy a residue of worldliness notable even in this Babylon of post-war Philadelphia. A step past deism, a purposed disconnection from Christ. South Philadelphia ballad singers, Ethelmer has meanwhile been instructing the room, generally tenors who are said in their succession to constitute a chapter in the secret history of a music yet to be, if not the modal change Plato feared, then one he did not foresee. Not even he, his mathematical cousin Depew, is disquieted. My point exactly, cries Ethelmer, who has been edging towards the spirits, mindful that at some point he shall have to edge past his cousin Tenebrae. 'Tis ever the sign of revolutionary times that street airs become hymns and roistering songs anthems, just as Plato feared. Hast heard the Negro music, the flatted fifths, the vocal portamente? 'Tis there sings your revolution. These late 10 American years were but slaughter of this sort and that. Now begins the true inversion of the world. Don't know, cuz, much of your faith seems invested in this novel music. Where better? Asks young Ethelmer confidently. Is it not the very rhythm of the engines, the clamor of the mills, the rock of the oceans, the roll of the drums in the night? Why, if one wished to give it a name... Surf music, Depew cries. Percussion, Bree, sweet as a pie. Very well to both of ye. Nonetheless, as you, Depew, shall one full moon, not too distant, be found haggling in the alleys with Caribbean Negroes over the price of some modest guitar upon which to strum this very music, so shall you, miss, be dancing to it at your wedding. Then you should be wearing this round your head, suggests Bree, quite upon her beat, if you wish to work as a gypsy. Handing him from her sewing basket a length of scarlet muslin, which the game Ethelmer has round his head in a trice. More a pirate than a gypsy, Bree opines. Yet just as romantic in its way. Chapter 27. Demagogue, mutters Dr. Franklin. Our excellent Sprout Penn, the latest of his crypto-Jesuit ruling family, and his satanic arrangement with Mr. Allen, his shameless attentions to the Presbyterian mobility, has the effrontery to speak of crushing this demagogue. Well, well, I, demagogue. Milton thought it a goblin word, that might yet describe good patriots. "Good patriots all," cries the impulsive Mr. Dixon, raising his cup. Dr. Franklin observes them, one at a time, through the tinted lenses of spectacles of his own invention, for moderating the glare of the sun, whose elevation upon his nose varies according to the message it happens to be inflecting, giving overall the impression of a visitor from very far away indeed. The geometers have encountered the eminent Philadelphian quite by chance, in the pungent and dim back reaches of an apothecary in Locust Street, each gentleman upon a distinct mission of chemical necessity, as among these shelves and bins, the Godfrey's cordial and Bateman's drops, Hooper's female pills, and Smith's medicinal snuff, hasty bargains are struck, strings of numbers and letters and alchemist signs whispered, and some never written down, whilst a quiet, warmed narcosis, as of a drawing to evening far out in a country of fields where drying herbal crops lie, just perceptibly breathing, possesses the shop's interior, rendering it indistinct as to size, legality, or destiny. Dixon is accosting at length a clerk who has taken him for one more English tourist hectically out in search of Chinaman's drugs. Anything, ideally with opium in it, will do. Alcohol to keep it in solution, of course. Perhaps some formulation that would go well with the Daffy's elixir of which we plan to purchase. How many cases was that again, Mr. Mason? Mason glares back, too keenly aware of the celebrated American philosopher's eye upon them, having hoped to project before it, somehow, at least the forms of precedence. But, of course, Dixon's rustic familiarities have abolished yet again any such hope. One more station of the cross to be put up with. Any matter of supply falls into your area, Dixon. Have a word with Mr. McLean, if you're not sure, hearing how it sounds, even as he goes on with it. Dixon remains cheery. In that welcome event, making a carefree motion in the air with his handkerchief, 100 cases should do the trick, for this time out anyway. Now, as to that opiated article we were discussing. Aye, we call it a laudanum, sir, compounded according to the original formulae of the noted Dr. Paracelsus of Germany. 100 cases, screams Mason. Have you gone insane? This is a church-going province. 'Twill never be authorized. Preventive against a variety of ailments, sir. Excellent anti-caustive properties, given the uncertainty of diet. The commissioners know all too well about Daffy's elixir and the uses 'tis put to. Mr. Franklin, who has been attending the exchange, here feels he must point out. And being imported, 'tis only to be had at prices charged in the English shops. Now, for a tenth of that outrageous sum, our good apothecary, Mr. Mispick, will compound you a salutis impossible to distinguish from the original. Or you may design your own, consulting with him as to your preferred ratio of jalap to senna, which variety of treacle pleases you. All the fine points of daffyolatry are known to him. He has seen it all, and nothing will shock or offend him. He raises a finger. Strangers, heed my wise advice. Never pay the retail price. This is kind of you, sir, for fair. Mr. Mason's choices, illustrative of a more bacchic leaning, enjoying priority of mine, so must I rest content with more modest outlays from my own meager purse, alas, for any filters peculiarly useful to myself. Dr. Franklin shifts his lenses as if for a clearer look at Dixon. A smile struggles to find its way through the lips pursed in speculation. But before it quite may, being the sort of man who, though never seen to consult a timepiece, always knows the exact time. Come, he bids the astronomers abruptly. You've not yet been to a Philadelphia coffee house. Oh, we must amend that. Something no visitor should miss. I must transact an item or two of business. Would you honor me by having a brief sip at my local, the Blue Jamaica? London, Mr. Mason is soon reporting, is quite thoroughly charmed by your glass harmonica, thanks to the artistry of the excellent Miss Davies. I have done my utmost to convince Miss Davies that, given the general frangibility, use of any strong vibrato could prove, putting it as gallantly as possible, unwise. Yet she plays so beautifully. My idle toy has found itself fortunately arrived among a small host of virtuosi. Heavens, the Mozart child! And these tales I keep hearing of the young Parisian doctor Mesmer, who plays it, 'tis said, unusually well. Not the magnetical gent, says Mason. The very same. known to the RS for some time, I collect. At the Mitre, he is ever reliable as a topic of lively discourse. Where Franklin is a member, and I've scarcely been a guest, Dixon may be muttering to himself. Aloud, "Excuse me, friend," briskly upon his feet, "where does one go over the heap around here?" Mr. Franklin points out to him a door to the yard, and when he is out of earshot, begins, it seems abruptly, to inquire about the surveyor's Calvert connections. Mason is perplexed. "I didn't know there were any. I imagined that being of a Quaker family, he was deemed acceptable to the Pennsylvanians, but have ever been at a loss to explain his appeal, if any, to the Marylanders." The Calverts are content to live in England. As they are Catholics, their children are educated across the channel in St. Omer. One of the Jesuits teaching there is a certain Lemaire, who is native to Durham and a particular friend of Dixon's teacher, William Emerson. "Yes, but you'd have to ask Dixon about the Jesuit. I know of him only as the partner of Roger Boscovich, the 2 degrees of latitude in Italy." From Rome to Rimini, aye. Franklin, behind his orchid-hued lenses, waits for Mason to work out the comparisons. "What's going on, then?" Mason, trying to peer, he hopes not as truculently as he feels, into the shadowy lunettes. "You might sometime find yourself discussing these matters with your second." After which, Mason replies, as Franklin suddenly, with naked, narrowed eyes, looks over the tops of his spectacles and nods encouragingly, "I am to relate the minutes of it all to you?" Mr. Franklin, replacing his glasses, "Not if it causes you discomfort, sir, although some discomforts may ever be eased by timely application of Ben's universal balm. Yet do others continue intractable. Why, Dr. Franklin, are you urging me to this, may I say, dismal choice?" "Oh, wagering against your loyalty," Franklin shrugs. "An elementary exercise, and pray do not feel you have in any way offended me. As an adult, I am no stranger to rejection. I have long learned to deal with it in dignity as a sane man would, and without resentment, motive for it, though, I may enjoy in abundance. Sir, I cannot spy upon him for you. I am sorry the politics here have become so, as one would say, Italian in their intricacies. But my contractual tasks alone will be difficult enough without... Ah, and here is Mr. Dixon. Do you know a lad named Lewis? Said he knew you, Dr. Franklin." Where was this? Franklin has begun twirling the hair upon either side of his head into long curls. "Just out in the alley, he tried to sell me a watch. Said it was a Masonic astrologer's model. Signs of the zodiac, phases of the moon." "You didn't?" "Couldn't, not unless one of you wants to lend me..." "I'll go have a look," Mason, rising. "Come along, Dixon, and point him out." "Eh, I think he's gone." Dixon, now preoccupied with pouring the contents of a small vial into his coffee. Mason, unable to insist without appearing to wish to consult out of Franklin's hearing and needing to piss anyhow, shrugs and withdraws. The moment he vanishes, Franklin begins to press Dixon upon the topic of Mason's East India Company connections. "Is thou the Dutch or the English one?" Dixon's fizz altogether innocent. "I'm ever confounding them." Franklin at last allowing himself to chuckle. "Friend Dixon, loyalty is a gem of worth innate, whose price is never noticed till too late. We've had an adventure or two, you see." "Ah, me. Don't suppose the name Sam Peach of Chalford would ring a bell?" With quizzical sincerity, "One of those lads in the Beggar's Opera?" "Well, well, Mr. Dixon, be easy, I release you. And look ye, here again is your companion." "The man's an entire instrument shop," says Mason. "Droll sort of friend for you to have, Dr. Franklin. Interesting wig. Told me a riddle, in fact. Why is the king like a nearsighted gunner?" "Well, damned if I know," I said back, "but Dr. Franklin is sure to." "Mr. Mason, dear, dear, how would I know any such joke, or person?" "Why, to help you find out how much, and how foolishly, we have to spend, perhaps," sing Mason and Dixon. "Phlogiston and electric fire," cries the eminent Philadelphia, "if I'm not the biter bit, as you'd say, transparent, was I? Awkward. Should have just asked them at the Royal Society, being a member after all. Indeed, I was among them at the time you fought the French vessel. In London, when you wrote to them, quite a hubbub, gentlemen. Though absent from the meeting which approved their reply to you, innocent, you understand, I did attend the next, a classic display of those people at their worst. Taken one at a time, dear Tom Birch, August Hadley, the Quadrant's eponym, Mr. Short, Dr. Morton, excellent minds, invigorating company. But when they got all in a herd, bless us, the stubbornness. They knew the French had been coolin' and would be as content to sink the Seahorse there as off Brest. They all knew, but they could never allow upstarts to advise them in matters of global strategy. Alas, the British, bloody-minded to the end, so long as it be somebody else's blood. Thus the Board of Trade, thus the House of Commons. Up there, day after day, instructing them, gently, a schoolmaster for idiots. Sooner or later, no offense, gentlemen, Americans must fight them. Hurrah! How be it? For I am rescued. He refers, in his courtly way, to the arrival of a pair of young women, both quite pleasant-looking, though decked out with what, even to the unschooled eye, seems willful eccentricity, and who may or may not have been among those in the carriage which had been earlier at the landing. There he is! Oh, doctor! More than vigorously nudging one another and laughing at differing rates of speed. These are Molly and Dolly, Franklin introduces them, students of the electrical arts, whom I am pleased from time to time to examine in the subject. Yes. If you've the inclination tonight, gentlemen, I am giving a recital upon the glass instrument at the sign of the Fair Anchor upon Carpenter's Wharf, just down from the London Coffee House. 'Tis a sort of, what is the word I grope for? Gin shop, sings Molly. Opium den, cries Dolly. Ladies, ladies. Doctor, doctor. As the philosopher, attempting to maintain his hair in some order, is slowly absorbed into a mirthful cloud of tartan-edged emerald green and luminous coral taffeta, prints with a lapdog motif, ribbons with sailor beware, no free kisses, be quick about it, and other humorous slogans woven into them. Flounces and loose hats and wandering tresses, the astronomers reckon it as good a moment as any to be off. Passing into the streets, they can hear Molly piping, "And she swore to me she saw it glowing in the dark." Outside, they stand, blinking. "I don't know. Hadn't thou imagined him as something more organized? Aye, by reputation, he is a man entirely at ease with the inner structures of time itself. Yet here he seems strangely unfocused, as we lensmen say?" Mason, rolling his eyes, "Perhaps we should pop into that Fair Anchor this evening. What think you?" "Aye, happen those two canny electricians will be there. Rather fancied old Dolly myself. Woman knows how to turn herself out. The notice?" Hearing what he imagines to be an emphasis upon two, Mason directs at Dixon an effortful smile, meaning, "Go ahead, but don't expect me to ascend wearily out of my melancholia just so everybody else can have their own idea of a good time," which happens to be the most Dixon would ever think of asking of him anyhow. And withal, when they show up at the Fair Anchor that night, it turns out to be Mason's sort of place, nicely, basic and bleak, discouraging every attempt, even grunting, that might suggest conviviality. The wood furniture carved upon, splintered and scarred, the stale ale as underhopped as 'tis overwatered. They secure a place along the bar, and presently Mr. Franklin appears, having exchanged his orchid spectacles for half lenses of nocturnal blue. The occupants of the room, hitherto strewn without more purpose than the human jetsam of any large seaport, all sit up at once, draw together, and with the precision of a long-rehearsed clack, begin to chatter of Miss Davies and Gluck and, ineluctably, Mesmer. The instrument awaits him, its nested crystal hemispheres, each tuned to a note of the scale, carefully brought hither through reefed topsail seas and likewise whelming anxieties back at Lloyd's regarding the inherent vice of glass added to the yet imperfectly known contingencies of voyage by ship, brought to shine in this commodious corner, beneath a portrait of some Swedish statesman too darkened with room smoke for anyone to be sure who it is any more. Oxenstierna, Gyllenstierna, Gyllenborg, who knows? Discussions often becoming quite spirited, though, of course conducted in Swedish. It has hung there, growing into its anonymity since the early times of the Swedish settlers, gazing into the room at the nightly dramas of lost consciousness and squandered coin, at gaming and roaring and varieties inexhaustible of argument. Behind it rises a flight of stairs, up and down which creeps a ceaseless traffic. Many pause to stare over the false mahogany railing at Dr. Franklin, seated at his glass harmonica, or down upon the figures and into the décolletages of Molly and Dolly, who not only have showed up, but have brought along two more young women with similar ideas about fashion. "These doxies," Mason mutters, "look ye, they're staring at me. I can feel myself becoming unreasonably suspicious." "Rest easy, 'tis me they want," Dixon waving. "Jerry, Charlie, over here." The ladies seem delighted. Dr. Franklin waits for the parties to rearrange their seating, then strikes a C major chord. The room quiets instantly. He begins to play, rotating by way of a treble arrangement, the horizontal stack of glasses through a trough of water to keep the rims ever wet, and then simply touching each wet rim, moving by, as he would have touched the keys of an organ, to produce a queerly hoarse ringing tone. If chimes could whisper, if melodies could pass away, and their souls wander the earth, if ghosts danced at ghost ridettos, 'twould require such music, sentiment, ever held back, ever at the edge of breaking forth, in fragments, as glass breaks. Upon one of his intermissions, the doctor, having secured a pot of ale, approaches the geometers. "Come and meet Mr. Tallyho of Virginia, who proves to be anxious that they visit with Colonel Washington of that province. You'll want to have a chat. He's been out there, knows the country, the inhabitants, surveyor like yourselves." Dixon here must suppress a chuckle, knowing how it annoys Mason to be styled so. "Bad enough at the Cape, calling us both astronomers," Mason has complained, and more than once. "I'm being insulted coming and going. It's not fair." "He's said to be of a Weir Valley family. They told me to look him up." At dawn, they are led to a remote crossroads north of the city. Out of the cold humidity rolls smoothly a coach of peculiar design. "But step aboard, gents, and this machine'll have you in Mount Vernon ere Phoebus lift his knob again." "Is it safe?" inquires Mason. "Perfectly. 'Tis the road that's perilous," Mr. Tallyho shaking both their hands in farewell. "You're not coming along," Dixon collects. "Not I. He'll not wish to see me. Lord's mercy, no." They ride all night, and neither sleeps. The coach stops for nothing. Meals, each a distinct kind of sandwich, are passed to them down through a hatch. The remains, including plates, are thrown out the window, taken by the wind. There are newspapers and a rack full of books, and under the driver's seat is a cask of Philadelphia porter, whose tap extends within for the use of the passengers. When they must piss, they do so into glazed jars with Chinese scenes upon them. By the time they consider pissing out the coach doors, so swiftly have they traveled that they miss the chance. The driver is calling, "Potomac just ahead, gents." He drops them off by the river into the slap and scent of winter upon the wing and points them uphill. Bearing nothing but what they may have stuffed hastily into their pockets, they begin the ascent to Mount Vernon. Chapter 28. In their decadency, these Virginians practice an elaborate folly of courtly love, unmodified since the Dark Ages, so relentlessly that at length they cannot distinguish fancy from the substantial world, and their folly absorbs them into itself. They gaily dance the steps their African slaves teach them, whilst pretending to an aristocracy they seem only to have heard rumors of. Their preferred sport is the duel. Part of the definition of gentleman in these parts seems to be ownership of a matched set of pistols. To anyone who has observed slave keepers in Africa, it will seem all quite ancient. Lords and serfs, a Gothic pursuit, what in our corrupted days has become of knights and castles when neither is any longer reasonable or possible. No good can come of such dangerous boobyism. What sort of politics may proceed herefrom, only he that sows the seeds of folly in his world may say. The Reverend Wicks Cherrycoke, Spiritual Day Book. Colonel Washington turns out to be taller than Dixon by about as much as Dixon rises over Mason. "Enable us quite nicely to stand in a shed if we keep a straight line," he greets them, though I wonder why. In this province of the unreflective, if the colonel serves not as a focus of sobriety, neither is he quite the incompetent fool depicted in the London press, rattling on, ever so jolly, about the whiz of enemy shot through the air, though how mean-spirited must we be to refuse slack in the sheets of manhood to a gangling sprig, sighting one day through the eyepiece of a surveyor's instrument upon a plummet string, the next down the barrel of a rifle at a Frenchman. In his mature person, though he will seem from time to time to allow his gaze to refocus upon something more remote, yet 'tis as little fidgeting as reverie, something purposeful, rather, allowing him to remain attentive to the topic at hand. When he hears Dixon speak, he smiles, though owing to the state of his teeth, he is reluctant to do so when in company. A smile from Colonel Washington, however tentative, is said to be a mark of favor. My people come from around your neck of the woods, I think, for I've relatives who talk the way you do. Dixon cups an ear. Happen I hear a fading echo of the old pitman's lilt. The colonel shrugs. Up in Pennsylvania, they tell me I talk like an African. They imagine us here surrounded with our tithables, insensibly sliding into their speech, and so, it is implied, into their ways as well. Come, observe this pitcher upon the table. An excellent punch, the invention of my man Gershom. Out on the white-columned porch, tumbler in fist, the large Virginian wants to talk real estate. Sometimes a man must act quickly upon an opportunity, for in volatile times the chance may never come again. Just for example, there is a parcel out past the South Mountain I'd like you to take a look at when you go by. Your line, as I project it, passing quite close. Spotted it early in the war, kept it in mind ever since. No reason you fellows shouldn't turn a shilling or two whilst you're over here. And have you considered how much free surveying you'll be giving away, as the West Line must contribute north and south boundaries to pieces innumerable? Don't suppose you have a copy of that contract you signed? Well, no matter. Yet I wonder at how you boys have stirred up the land jobbers. No one here regards the crest of the Alleghenies as the barrier it was. You've only to look at the roads. Some day the wagons in a stream unbroken. New faces and ships arriving every day. Nothing east of Susquehanna left to settle. The French are out of the Ohio. The scoundrel Pontiac is vanquished. The money is ready. Coffee houses in a frenzy of map sketching and bargaining. What deters us? General Bouquet's proclamation, Mason suggests. No new settlement west of the Allegheny ridgeline. Oh, the proprietors won't enforce that. Whence, then, replies Mason, the rumor that Mr. Cresap tried to bribe the general with 25,000 acres not to proclaim his line? Perhaps, chuckles Washington, 'twas all the old renegado dared promise, and Bouquet may have wanted more. As no land may be had there now but by his warrant, his line might make of him an American nabob. As he was not offering his services out of love for those inexpensive tokens with which he is synonymous, rather, the Lord, ever merciful, as in Bengal, sent us a deliverer whose appetite for profit matches his self-confidence. 'Twas business, more or less plainly dealt. The next step will be to contract our Indian wars out to mercenaries, preferably schooled in Prussian techniques, as it never hurts to get the best, though many of these hired professionals miss one payday and they're gone like smoke. Could even be just before a decisive battle. Forget it, damn 'em, they're off. Did you imagine Bouquet or the Pens to be acting out of tender motives toward the Indians? Why else refrain from expanding west, mildly inquires Dixon, but out of a regard for the humanity of those whose homes they invade? A motive even stronger and purer, frowns Colonel Washington, the desire to confound their enemies, who chiefly are the Presbyterians settling the west, proclamation schlocklamation. Ulster Scots who hate England enough to fight against her now the French are departed, though the cheerfully idiotic, who are numerous, believe such sectarian passions to lie behind us. The Ulster Scots were dispossessed once, shamefully, herded, transported, hostages to the demands of religious geography. Then, a second time, were they forced to flee the rack rents of Ulster for this American unknown. Think ye there will be any third coercion? At what cost, pray? Americans will fight Indians whenever they please, which is whenever they can, and Brits wherever they must, for we will be no more contained than taxed. The Grenville ministry ignore these data at their peril. Mr. Grenville, alas, neglects to consult me in these matters, says Mason. Wrote to him, adds Dixon. Tax the East India Company, why don't they? Did he even reply? as a rule here, advises the colonel, you may speak your minds upon any topic political, but on no account ever discuss religion. If any insist, represent yourselves as deists. The back inhabitants are terrified of all atheists, especially the Indians, though Englishmen bearing unfamiliar equipment across their land might easily qualify. Their first impulse upon meeting an atheist is to shoot at him, often at close range, though some of the Lancaster County rifles are deadly from a mile off, so running for cover is largely out of the question. Besides, you cannot know what may be waiting among the trees. "What's that aroma?" Dixon blurts, knowing quite well from the Cape what it is. "Ah, the new harvest. How inhospitable of me. 'Tis but a small patch out back, planted as an experiment. If it prospers, next season perhaps we'll plant 10 acres as a market crop. With luck, between the Navy and the New York fops, we could get rid of it all, mail and thimble, and see us some profit. Always a few shillings in canary seed as well, worse comes to worst. Here then, Gershom, where be you at, my man?" An African servant with an ambiguous expression appears. "Yes, Massa Washington, sir." "Gershom, fetch us, if you will, some pipes and a bowl of the new cured hemp, and another gallon of your magnificent punch. There's a good fellow. Truly, gentlemen, an Israelite in whom there is no guile." Mason, recognizing the source as John, chapter 1, verse 49, actually chuckles, whilst Dixon rather glowers. At Raby Castle, he informs them, fizz aflame, Darlington liked to joke of his steward, my great Uncle George, using that same quotation from the Bible. Yet only from our Savior, surely, might such words be allowed to pass without raising suspicions as to amplitude of spirit. From the Earl of Darlington, the remark was no more than an unconsidered jollity one expects of a castle dweller. But to hear it in America is an enigma I confess I am at a loss to explain. "Good sir," the colonel, smiting himself repeatedly upon the head, under knocking his wig askew, "I regret providing the text for an unwelcome association." He snatches the wig completely off and bows his head, cocking one eye at Dixon. "The two conditions are entirely separate, of course." "I'm a Quaker," shrugs Dixon. "What am I supposed to do, call thee out?" "Don't bother about that Israelite talk anyhow," Gershom coming back in with a tray. "It's his way of joking. He does it all the time." "Thou aren't offended?" "As I do happen to be of the Hebrew faith," tilting his head so that all may see the traditional Jewish yarmulke attached to the crown of his peruke in a curious display of black on white, "it would seem a waste of precious time." "Say, and cook," beams George Washington. "Gersh, any of them kasha varnishkis left?" "Believe you ate 'em all up for breakfast, Colonel." "Well, why don't you just whop up another batch? Maybe fry us some hog jowls. Hep it slide on down." "One big mess of hog jowls coming right up, sir." "Wait a minute," objects Mason. "Do the Jews not believe that," glancing over at Dixon, "the article you speak of is unclean, and so avoid scrupulously its flesh?" "Please, you don't think I feel guilty enough already? As it happens, the sect I belong to is concerned scarce at all with dietary rules of any kind," adds the colonel, having inhaled mightily upon his pipe, whence now arises another aromatic cloud. "Yet if a Jew cooking pork is a marvel, what of a Negro working a room? Yes, my oath, here is Joe Miller resurrected. They applaud him round a circuit of coaching inns upon the roads to Georgetown, Williamsburg, and Annapolis. Indeed, he is known far and wide as a theatrical artist of some attainment, leaving him less and less time for his duties here, not to mention an income per annum which creeps dangerously close to that of his nominal master, me." He passes the pipe to Dixon. "He wants me to put it in Dismal Swamp Land Company shares," Gershom confides. "How would you gentlemen advise me?" Mason and Dixon make eye contact, Dixon blurting, "Didn't they tell us..." Mason going, "Shh, shh." Washington, meanwhile, trying to wave Gershom back into the house. Gershom, however, has just taken the pipe from Mr. Dixon. "Thank you." Inhales. Presently, "Well, how are you, gentlemen? You having a good time? That's quite some coat you're wearing, sir. It's, certainly is red, ain't it? And those silver buttons, mighty shiny. Tell me, seriously now, you were planning to wear this out into the forest?" Why, aye. Actually, bright red. It's quite a la mode out there, seen rather often, down the barrels of cheap rifles. You'll be very popular with all kinds of folk. Delawares, Shawnees, Seneca. Seneca fancy a nice red coat. So, passing the pipe to Mason, I can see which one's the snappy dresser. Whilst the Indians are shooting at him, the Presbyterians will be after you, thinking you're something to eat. It's a buffalo, I'm telling you, mon. Hush, Patrick, it seemed but a squirrel to me. So it's a squirrel. Psst, pow. Obliged, of course, squawks Mason, ever so kind to imagine for me my death in America. Need no longer preoccupy myself upon the matter. Kind, yes, and withal a great relief. Gershom, turning to Dixon, is he always like this, or does he get indignant sometimes? You see what I have to put up with, groans Colonel Washington. It's making me just me shugana. Here, a bit of tobo with that. George. Uh-oh. Stay calm. It's the wife. Just let me do the... Ah, my treasure. Excellent gown. Handsome stuff. Allow me to present, and so forth. Mrs. Washington. Oh, la, call me Martha, boys, is a diminutive woman with a cheerful rather than happy air, who seems to bustle even when standing still. At the moment, she is carrying an enormous tray piled nearly beyond their angles of repose with tarts, popovers, gingerbread figures, fried pies, stuffed doughnuts, and other units of refreshment the surveyors failed to recognize. Smelled that smoke, figured you'd be needing something to nibble on, the doughty Mrs. W. greets them. The task, as usual, falling to that agent of domesticity unrelenting, the wife, as none of you could run a house for more than 10 minutes in the world wherein most of us must dwell without anarchy setting in. I was supposed to be watching a pot upon the fire, sighs Washington. Matters more immediate claimed my attention, one giving rise to yet another, till a certain odor recalled me to the pot, alas, too late. Another ruinous flaw in my character, perhaps one day to be amended by me, though never to be forgiven by my lady. She shakes her head, eyes yawing more than rolling. George, have a cookie. He takes a molasses gingerbread man, closely examines its reverse, as if to assure himself that his wife hasn't somehow burned it, and is about to bite the head off when something else occurs to him. Now, you may have heard of the Ohio Company, a joint adventure in which my late brothers had a few small shares. There we were, as deep in the savage state as men have been known to venture, often no clear line of retreat, a sort of, Marth, my nosegay of virtues, what's a piece of tricky weaving? How, she replies, pray, would I know? Am I a weaver? A piece of tricky weaving, the colonel has tried to continue, order, I mean to say, in chaos. Markets appearing, with their unwritten laws, upon every patch of open ground, power beginning to sort itself out, line and staff. Mason and Dixon, in arranging for a fair division of labor, have adopted the practice, whenever two conversations are proceeding at once, of each attending one, with location usually deciding who gets which. So it falls to Mason to defend his profession against what he suspects is Mrs. W.'s accusation of unworldliness, whilst Dixon must become enmeshed in Ohio Company history. With our own forts at Wills and Redstone Creeks, and a communication between. As the East India Company hath its own navy, why, so did we our own army. Out in the wild anarchy of the forest, we alone had the coherence and discipline to see this land developed as it should be. Rest easy that the old O.C. still exists, the colonel is protesting, though in different form. Sounds like the afterlife, Gershom remarks. If only we could have gotten the language we wanted in the charter, the tale might have been different. But our friends at court are few, and now and then invisible, even to us. They failed to get the Bishop of Durham clause, puts in Gershom. Look ye, wasn't it like iron plate upon a steam boiler for everyone else? Virginia, the Calverts, the Penns? Ohio, by precedent, surely is entitled to one. All respect, Colonel, those grants, Gershom points out, were more like fantastical tales, drafted in the days of some kings who were not altogether real themselves. 'Twas a world of masking then, fictions of faraway lands, what did they care? Bishop of Durham clause? No problem with that. How can we set you up, a Palatine residence? 'Tis yours. You like cedar shakes, brick, traditional stone approach, whatever, it's fine. What's that? You want to put in a what? A harem? Why, to be sure. And how many ladies would that be, sir? Of course you've a choice. Lord Smedley, the catalog, please. Any bishop of Durham clause in America, says Dixon, suggests a likeness in the British mind between your Indians west of the Allegheny Ridge and their Scots beyond Hadrian's Wall. As the bishop prince's half of the bargain is to defend the king against whatever wild cannibal host lies north of us, whose nightly bagpipe music, in the time of the 45, could easily bring all within earshot to insomniac terror by dawn. Why, sir, exclaims the colonel, you might be describing a camp upon Monongahela, and the death hollows all night from across the river. The long watchfulness, listening to the brush, every miserable last leaf, the darkness implacable. When you gentlemen come to stand at the boundary between the settled and the unpossessed, just about to enter the deep woods, you will recognize the sensation. Yet we sought no more than to become that encampment in the night, that small refuge of civilization in the far wilderness. Trouble was, so did the French, Gershom remarks. Thank ye, Gersh. Mason, meanwhile, is embarked upon an apologia for astronomy and his own career therein. The dispute is at least as old as Plato. Indeed, I feel like Glaucon in the 7th book of the Republic, nervously listening for Socrates all the practical reasons he can think of for teaching astronomy in the schools. Let's see, then, do I feel like Socrates? Alas, sir, I think not today, nor Mrs. Socrates neither, that no doubt otherwise excellent lady being, as I am told, far too busy with shrewish pursuits to bother with her kitchen, and thus scarcely able to suggest to you, for example, this excellent apricot tart. Mason is not sure, but thinks he has just detected a certain silial excursion. Obliged, ma'am. All lens fellows, I mean, recognize that our first duty is to be of public use. Oh, the raspberry too, then, thank ye. Even with the Pelhams currently in eclipse, we all must proceed by way of the established routes, with every farthing we spend charged finickingly against the royal purse. We are too visible up on our hilltop to spend much time among unworldly speculations, or indeed aught but the details of our work, focused in particular these days upon the problem of the longitude. Oh, and what happened to those transits of Venus? There we have acted more as philosophical frigates, ma'am, each detached upon his commission, whilst the everyday work of the observatories goes on as always, for the task at Greenwich, as at Paris, is to know every celestial motion so perfectly that sailors at last may trust their lives to this knowledge. Here, the colonel beams, more fame attaches to the transits. Observers stationed all round the world, even in Massachusetts. Treasuries of all lands pouring forth gold. Every astronomer suddenly employed, and all to find a true value for the Earth's parallax. Why, most of us here in Virginia wouldn't know a parallax from a pinwheel if it came on up and said, "How do you do?" Yet what a rage it was, the transit of Venus wig that several women were seen wearing upon Broad Street. Husband, do you remember it? A dark little round knot against a great white powdered sphere. And that transit of Venus pudding, same thing, a single black current upon a circular field of white. And the sailors with that miserable song. "'Tis time to set sail," sings the colonel. "Farewell, Portsmouth ale. Ta-ta to the gay cantinas, for we're off, my girl, to the end of the world, to be there ere the transit of Venus. She's the something-something." Goddess of love, Martha in a pleasant though impatient soprano, shining above, without a bit of meanness, though we'll have no more fun till she's crossed o'er the sun, 'tis ho for the transit of Venus. Colonel Washington joining her for the bridge. Out where the trade winds blow, further than sailors go, if it's not ice and snow, 'twill be hotter than hell, we know. So, wave to your dear, stow all your gear, and show a bit of keenness. Bid Molly adieu, for she isn't for you are for the transit of Venus. By the last four bars they are facing and gazing at one another with an affection, having to do not so much with the lyric as with keeping the harmony and finishing together. Gershom is presently telling king jokes. Actually, they're slave and master jokes retailored for these audiences. King says to his fool, "So, tell me honestly, what makes you willing to go about like such a fool all the time?" Hey, George, says the fool, that's easy. I do it for the same reason as you, out of want. What, goes the king, how's that? Why, you for want of wit, and I for want of money. The king is jesting with one of his ambassadors. Damme, he cries, if you don't look like some great disheveled sheep. Ambassador replies, I know that I've had the honor several times to represent your majesty's person. The king, merry but distraught, asks leave of those at his table to toast the devil. Why, says the fool, where that gentleman resides, he is already well toasted. Yet I could never object to one of your majesty's particular friends. The king takes a long coach ride out into the country and decides to walk back to the palace in company with his fool. Growing at length fatigued, they learn of a farmer they meet that they've 10 miles yet to go. Maybe we'd better send for the carriage, says the king. Come on, George, replies the fool, we can do it easily, 'tis but 5 miles apiece. Gershom follows these by singing Hava Nagila, a merry Jewish air, whilst clicking together a pair of spoons in syncopation. "'Twas Céloron de Bienville, who began the dispute in 49, recalls the colonel later, when he voyaged south from Canada, landing upon the shore of Lake Erie, following French Creek to the Allegheny, where, to assert France's claims, he buried a lead plate, bearing the royal seal. Thence by bateau to the Ohio, and down it, past Allegheny, Beaver, Fish Creek, Muskingum, Kanawha, Scioto, planting as he went these leaden flags at the mouths of each stream in turn. Lead? Dixon, curiously. A memorandum, it seems to Mason, of other uses for the metal, such as shot. Another expression of that famous French contempt, not only to be prodigal with a base metal, but to bury it in the dirt and the dark, as if that were the only way an Englishman might notice it. Oh, sir, likely 'twas practicality, beams Washington. Lead being cheaper than silver or gold, and if kept out of the air that way, quite durable as well. Any metal in the form of a plate, Dixon muses, or disc, might plausibly have an electrical purpose. Have a word with Dr. Franklin, offers the colonel. He'll know. Electricity again. Mason gestures at his partner with his thumb, shaking his head morosely. Aye, 'tis the topic that most provokes his disorder. Quite harmless, of course. Comes over him without warning. Suddenly he's on about his favorite fluid, and no stopping him. Even Dr. Franklin can shed no light. The best physicians of the Royal Society, a shrug, baffled. We but hope one day he may regain his senses. A childhood misadventure with a torpedo, Dixon, with a brief movement of his head toward Mason, confides, thus his sensitivity at all references to the electrical. Shocking, Gershom remarks, and Mrs. W. beats Tata, Mama smartly upon the tabletop, whilst the colonel holds his head as if it ached. Yet not dazed enough, Mason assures the company, nor too young, to miss recognizing in the torpedo 5/6 of whose length is taken up with these electrical plates, the principle of all these structures, which is that you must stack a great many of them, one immediately upon the next, if you wish to produce any effect large enough to be useful in, let alone noticed by, the world. Aye, Dixon, well might you wag your head. Wag away, may it circulate some sense. For what possible use a single plate, lead or gold, buried in the earth is beyond me. Perhaps only beyond our sensorium. How feeble, replies Dixon. As were the heavens, you may recall, but a short while ago, before telescopes were invented. Why may not these plates collectively form a telluric laden pile? If not for storing quantities of simple electric force, then to hold smaller charges, easily shaped into invisible symbols, decipherable by means surely available to those philosophes. I fear the only message upon those discs was a challenge, sir, a provocation, asserts Washington, the surveyor's equivalent of a slap from a glove. And yet, speculates the Reverend, what else? There remains a residue of belief out to the westward that the mere presence of glyphs and signs can produce magical effects. For of the essence of magic is the power of small magical words to work enormous physical wonders, as of coded inscriptions in fables, once unlocked, to yield up treasure past telling. So seals become of primary moment, and their precise descriptions, often matters of life and death, for one letter misplaced can summon destruction immediate and merciless. You saw such plates? I dug a few of them up. Eyes etched in crimson, the colonel is grinning at Dixon meaningfully, while Mrs. Washington grimaces in warning. But Gershom is already on the way to fetch the mementos, calling mischievously, "Coming right up, sir. Bunch of dead weights. Beg pardon, lead plates. What did I say? Practically new. Original soil yet in place. Does the gentleman know how to divert guests?" What immediately draws Dixon's attention is not the royal seal of France, but the markings upon the reverse side. Bless us, 'tis Chinese. Chinese? Remarkable, sir. The only Europeans who recognize such writing seem usually to be the Jesuits. Excuse me, Dixon immediately upon the defensive. Problem here, Colonel? Depends, the Colonel replies with a pause whose heft all can appreciate. Are you a traveling man? Why, I, Dixon having learned of the Masonic password from a lodge member in Philadelphia, and I'm traveling west. West? Oh, ha, ha. Well, and so you are. Look ye, 'tis simply this, that from time to time a Jesuit up north in Quebec will put off his skirts for breeches and cross the border in disguise to work some mischief down here. So a fellow has to be extra vigilant, is all. Report everything to the lodge, so that way somebody there can piece together a great many small items into a longer tale, perhaps even trace the movements, day to day, of these sinister intruders. Speaking as Postmaster General, Dr. Franklin will later amplify back in Philadelphia, I see our greatest problem is time, never anything but time. For any message to reach its recipient, we must reckon in a fixed delay, months by ship, days over land, whilst via the Jesuit telegraph they enjoy their damned marvel of instant communication, far-reaching and free of error, thanks to giant balloons sent to great altitudes, mirrors of para, not to mention diabolical perfection, beams of light focused to hitherto unimagined intensities. So, at any rate, say the encrypted reports that find their ways to the desks of highly placed men, whose daily task it is to make sure they know everything appropriate to their places that must be known. As expected of a Jesuit invention, timing and discipline are everything. It is rumored that the fathers limit themselves to giving orders, whilst the actual labor is entrusted to the telegraph squads, elite teams of converted Chinese, drilled through Loyolan methods, to perform with split-second timing the balloon launchings, to learn the art of aiming the beam, and its reflection once acquired, to keep most faithfully fixed upon it. For, like the glance of a woman at a ball, it must be held for a certain time before conveying a message. So we ever lag behind them, by gaps of time none of us knows how to make up. If we could but capture one machine intact, we might take it apart to see how it works. Yet, what use? They'll only invent another twice as fiendish. For here are conjoined the two most powerful sources of brain power on earth. The one is closely harnessed to its disciplined rage for Jesus, as the other to that escape into the void, which is the very Asian mystery. Together, they make up a small army of dark engineers who could run the world. The Sino-Jesuit conjunction may prove a greater threat to Christendom than ever the Mongols or the Moors. Pray that more than the quarrel over feng shui divides them. Chapter 29. Cities begin upon the day the walls of the shambles go up, to screen away blood and bloodletting, animals' cries, smells, and soil, from residents already grown fragile before country realities. The better off live far as they may from the concentration of slaughter. Soon, country melancholics are flocking to town like crows, darkening the sun. Dressed meats appear in the market, sausages hang against the sky, forming lines of text, cryptic intestinal commentary. The Veery brothers, professional effigy makers, run an establishment south of the shambles at 2nd and Market Streets by the courthouse. Mason, in unabating search after the grizzly, must pay a visit. "Can't just have any old bundle of rags up there, even if 'tis meant to be burnt to ashes, can we?" says Cosmo. "Our mobility like to feel they're burning something, don't you see? Oh, we do jackboots and petticoats, bread and butter items the year round, yet we strive for at least the next order of magnitude. Here, for example, our public beheading model, adds his brother Damien, or the topper, as we like to call it, key to everything being the neck, of course, for after you've led them up to the one great moment, how can you disappoint them with any less than that nice satisfying chunk as the blade strikes, isn't it? And will pure beeswax do the job? No, fine for the head and whatever, but look what you've got to chop at. Spine, throat, muscles in the neck, well, not exactly wax, is it? So it's on with the old smock. Lovely visit next door, scavenging among the appropriately sized necks for bones and suet and such. Then it's up to the kitty here to cover it all over and give it a head with a famous, or better, infamous face. He's a rare wax artist, our Cosmo is. Likenesses almost from another world, perhaps not a world many of us would find that comfortable. Products of the innocent hive, sir, and beneath the refuse of the daily slaughter. Yes, there you have it. A grisly amalgam, perhaps even a sort of teaching. Sure, you'd enter any darkened room our lads and lasses happen to be in, only upon ill advice indeed. Which, of course, is exactly what Mason runs out and contrives to do as soon as he gets a chance. He and Dixon go tavern hopping and find secret society meetings in the back rooms of every place they visit. There is gambling, Madeira, carryings on. Some invite them to join. Some they do join. What, no floggings? No bare-breasted acolytes in chains? No ritual deflorations? Drinking games with Madeira, that's it? Some of these collegia, learning that Mason's name is Mason, claim to be Freemasons of one lodge and another. Anyone whose name is Mason is automatically a member, the first of your name likely having worked as a stonemason back in the era of the great cathedrals. As you are descended from him, so are Freemasons today descended from his guild fellows. You are a Mason ex nominee, as some might describe it. Unless, of course, 'twas an elaborate scheme to avoid paying for drink. In one of these ale venues, somewhere between the Indian Queen and the Duke of Gloucester, there proves to be a back room, for purposes of uninvited inspection, a pantry, but in fact an arsenal for various mob activities. Anyone else out in church of gothical experiences might have found it neither quite ancient nor ominous enough to bother with. But Mason can ever locate those spaces most fertile for the husbanding of melancholy. So now, blundersome, in he steps, candleless as well, relying upon the light of a lantern hanging outside the small window, waiting for his eyes to adjust, making out first two figures, then three, and at length the room full, erect, crowding close, without breath or pulse. His immediate need is to speak, not challenging but pleading. Slowly, as he is able to make out more of the faces, what he fears grows less deniable. They are directing, nowhere but into his own eyes, stares unbearable with meaning he cannot grasp, as if he does not wish to examine this too closely, as if they know him and withal expect him. Mason is certain he saw at least one of them at the first meeting with the commissioners the week previous, though that being largely ceremonial, all the faces then had been framed in more or less identical wigs. Yet if he recognizes me, Mason asks himself now, why doesn't he speak? Groping within for the gentleman's name, as the enigmatic fizz continues in the weak light to sharpen toward revelation. As it will prove, all the effigies in the back room bear faces of commissioners for the boundary line. Though Mason, anxiously upon the lookout wherever in town they have to go, won't fully appreciate it till the second meeting on 1 December. The calm, oval room has been furnished hastily, but minutes before their arrival, with a perfect row of black, comb-backed chairs for the commissioners set upon one side of a long table, facing a window revealing a late autumnal garden. White statues of uncertain gender leaning in sinuous poses, and across the table, two chairs of ordinary Second Street origin and faux Chippendale carving, unmatched, intended for the astronomers, who will have little to look at but the commissioners. Luckily for Mason, the gentlemen enter, not all in a troop, but in ones and pairs, so giving him a few extra moments in which to work upon his composure, which needs it. Those waxen faces that gazed at him with such midnight intent, here are their daytime counterparts to greet him with the same, oh God, in thy tender mercy, the same look, as if deliberately to recall the other night. But how could they, could anyone, know, Has he been under surveillance ever since landing here? And the figures in that far back room, were they not effigies at all, but real people, only pretending to be effigies? Yes, these very faces. Ah! What did he interrupt them at, then, in the lampless chamber? What gathering he wasn't supposed to know about? And why couldn't he remember more clearly what had happened to him after he went into the room? Was his brain, in mercy, withholding the memory? As the progress of wax automata, by ones and twos, approaches, provoking, daring Mason to bring any of it up, the possibility never presents itself to him that all the line commissioners from both provinces, being political allies of the proprietors, are natural and obvious effigy fodder to a mobility of rent payers. As will be later pointed out by Dixon, who has now begun casting him curious, offended looks. Neither has slept well for a fortnight, amid the house-rocking ponderosities of commercial drayage, the barrels and sledges rumbling at all hours over the paving stones, the town on a hammering and bricklaying itself together about them, the street sellers' cries, the unforeseen coalescences of sailors and citizens anywhere in the neighboring night to sing liberty and wreak mischief, hoofbeats in large numbers passing beneath the window, the cries of beasts from the city shambles. Philadelphia in the dark, in an all-night din residents may have got accustomed to, but which seems to the astronomers, not yet detached from the liquid, dutiful lurches of the packet through the October seas, the very mill of hell. Worse than London by far, Mason brushing away bugs, rolling over and over, four sides at 5 minutes per side, a goose upon insomnia's spit, uncontrollably humming to himself an idiotic gallop from the Rebel Weaver, which he attended in London just before departure, instead of Mr. Arne's Love in a Cottage, which would have been wiser. Smells of wood smoke, horses, and human sewage blow in the windows along with the noise. Somewhere down the street, a midnight church congregation sings with a fervency unknown in Sapperton, or in Bisley, for that matter.